to the Startup Voyage, and in this episode, we take a critical look at the less discussed aspects of Web3. In this episode, I've labeled it Web3, the unveiled, the ugly truth behind this tech revolution. Now, we'll explore some key topics that shed light on some of the challenges, the controversies, and the complexities that are now existing in Web3. And today, we have our guest, Andrew Kay, brings his extensive experience in the industry to provide a nuanced understanding of these issues. He is the founder of Web3 Research, an innovative company that's making Web3 more accessible to everyone. And his journey in the crypto world is nothing short of remarkable. With a background that intertwines technology and business, Andrew has been at the forefront of the Web3 for over a decade. He's not only been one of the youngest managers at Berkshire Hathaway, their R&D division, but he's also led his own DeFi projects and run a successful Web3 marketing agency, which I have lots of questions around that, your experience around that. But what's truly exciting is his current venture, Web3 Research, a beacon in the Hong Kong Science Park, currently developing a crypto influencer report, which is a tool that promises to guide crypto enthusiasts in navigating the complex waters of market trends, avoiding scams, and enhancing the research. Andrew is here to offer his unique perspective on the crypto space, drawing from his extensive knowledge and experiences, from his gritty technical aspects of Web3 to the broader social and ethical implications of crypto. He's ready to tackle it all on this show. But that's not all. Andrew will share his personal journey in the Web3 world, his own challenges and failures, and the successes that have shaped his path. He's not just an expert. He's an enthusiast who shares our values of honesty, integrity, and innovation in Web3. So, Andrew, I'd like to welcome you to the show. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here with us today.
Thanks for having me. I think one of the things you neglected to mention about my history is I've also lost a lot of money and time, navigating this Web3 space, as well. And I think that's also important. That's one of the reasons why we're having the conversation today. But thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think it's one of those things. I mean, for sure, it's one of the things I was going to get to. People right now in the space are probably pretty happy making some money with a lot of these altcoins and Solana blockchain doing really well, and a lot of more speculation that's happening. What's going to happen next year? But the funny thing I always have to say is, like, no one ever talks about when they lose money, right? So when you're on the chat, people are saying, "Hey, look at my portfolio," and they're showing the charts and seeing how everything jumps. Given this assumption that I just just loaded up, on some coin, but no one talks about when things are lost. But we'll get into that. But I think where I want to kick off as a core topic, and I think it's important going in to 2024. And in the past, look, ever since the crypto winter, we all know that everyone has been purely focused on building something real, sustainable. The idea of raising through token sales, yes, it's still happening, but it's not as popular. People are actually really building stuff. But with that said, I think still what Web3 and blockchains, it's still early days. And one of the challenges has been interoperability. And we think Web3 is supposed to be the seamless integration, but we know, from history that it takes a while for diverse platforms to work together to really benefit from a fully functional decentralized internet. And it's going to be a challenge, and everyone's fighting to be the L1 that will, kind of take over everyone else. There's a lot of L2s coming back on board. And I think the real world example is just basically the difficulty in achieving cross-chain compatibility among different blockchain platforms, with each blockchain operating its own set of rules and protocols. So it makes it pretty hard. So I'd like to kind of start there. In your experience, I'd like you to, kind of share what you do at Web3 Research and how you've approached this chaotic space in building in Web3?
Yeah, it right now, I mean, it's just a great question. I think right now, it's the Wild West and yeah. everybody's making anything, and you know, it's not even the technical aspects of it, but just looking at it, you know, we're talking about the next generation of adoption. What is an L1? What is an L2? You know, I even work with a company that claims they're a layer 0.5. you know what I mean? Yeah. So there's a lot of this infrastructure level, compatibility issues, consensus mechanisms, and dealing with bridges. And every single bridge, at least to my knowledge, has been hacked in some way or another, because you have to deal with this thing that essentially gets pulled off chain, or there's some centralization thing. And these are, you know, points of attack, and they're not really Web3. There's a lot of Web3 that's not Web3. There's a couple of ways that it can get solved. Like, I know Polkadot's trying to do some things. Cosmos is trying to do this. So there's this layer protocol oriented solution that's trying to get solved. I work with a company called Oort. They got rebranded from CCN. It's a Stanford professor, actually, who came up with it. And that's another infrastructure layer. They're the 0.5 solution. There's also, you know, you could do it, I guess, not to use layer, you could do it sort of a stratosphere up and at a wallet level. If you're talking about interoperability of, you know, if my Ethereum chain link and my Solana chain link, you know, how that works, you could do it at the wallet level. I think the most important thing here, though, isn't necessarily the tech. That's for the builders to figure it out. But the end user, they don't care.
Sure.
They don't care what chain it's on, right? They just want it to work. And so I think the real problem to solve is, how can you create this frictionless experience? Because if I have to, worry about going through these other, if I'm trying to go over to Polygon from Ethereum and I have to go through these extra steps, or I have to switch wallets, or I have to deal with these bridges that have, you know, inherent security issues, you're starting to turn off a large population of people who are trying to use this technology. So I think, you know, there's a lot of security vulnerability issues. There's fundamental infrastructure issues that need to be resolved. But I think fundamentally what builders need to be focusing on is, hey, the end user is not really going to care what chain that this thing is on, right? They're not purists like the rest of us. Right. A lot of builders come into this space with this mentality, like, I'm EVM only, or I'm Bitcoin purist, or I'm whatever it is. But a lot of people, they cannot be expected to understand what these things are. So, you know, they're going to go towards like a centralized exchange, because that kind of puts all these things into one little basket. And the centralized exchange, I'm not advocating necessarily for centralized exchanges, but what they're doing is essentially solving some of these issues by dealing with all the things in the background.
Well, I think that makes sense. If you even think about, first of all, a lot of trust has been broken in this space through a lot of scams and hacks. Yeah, there's a lot of peers still in the space. Even for myself, I remember the first time thinking about receiving actually some monies into my MetaMask wallet, and then deciding, okay, which chain should I use because I want to save money, right? So then you kind of have to figure it out, right? You know, what's going to be cheaper? Mm-hmm. So I moved over to BSC because, you know, it was fast and it was cheap, right? And yeah, you're right to that point that the users don't want to think about that. But on the other side of things, you hear about the issues with Ledger and what they're having right now. That in itself is sort of like, you know, Ledger's a huge reputable name in the industry when it comes to cold wallet storage. And you hear about these hacks that happen, and you know, how do you address that? I mean, at the end of the day, like, that's what you're saying. It's, you got to build a user experience that's, very simple and almost as if mimics what people are used to today. Like, people don't want to see anything that's different, right?
Yeah. I mean, and that was one of the mistakes I made early on. So there's a branding and language component to this as well.
Yeah.
Because I kept all my Bitcoin on Mt. Gox back in the day, because I was like, this is just like Bank of America. This is just like Citi. Yeah. And I keep it here. And this is a central authority that's going to take care of it for me. Obviously, I was very wrong. This is one of many times where I didn't understand, I didn't understand custody or some of these fundamental mechanisms that are important in the Web3 space. And I took a haircut on that. So I think that there's another component to this as well, which is you as an end user, how much risk are you willing to take on board? There's a spectrum of people who are like, I'll keep everything on a central exchange because it's easy. I'm lazy. And, I trust CZ. And the other side is like, well, no, not your keys, not your coins.
Right.
And so I feel like there's a comfort level that you need to be aware of, because it's not I don't think it's a one size fits all solution at the end as well, because everybody could have a Ledger cold wallet. There's a lot of friction there, tapping all the little buttons and then plugging it in, and then the USB doesn't work. So it's like, how much friction are you willing to deal with? How much risk are you willing to take on? Because if I have my entire bank account just carrying around in my pocket, it's a little, little sketchy for me. So maybe there is a centralized component to this that that people need to ease their way into or on ramp into as well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you got two sides of everything. And I think the majority of the population is still very used to banking the way it is today. And they're not shouting like, oh, you can't trust banks, right? They're not shouting that, right? But do you still see, I mean, with that level of risk, that's the one thing I could never understand. Okay, if you had maybe 5,000 USD or USDC on your person, right? You might feel okay about it. But when you start getting more and more, I mean, 10,000, 20,000, 25,000, it's no different than, in a way, maybe not exactly, but if I'm stashing stacks of cash, paper currency in my house or in a safe, it kind of feels like the same thing, except that it's a little bit more worrisome, because you got this little device, right? That maybe one day there would be some hiccup on that little device. Maybe it doesn't work. Maybe it doesn't read. I don't know. So I think it's kind of crazy, kind of thinking about that.
Yeah. And another component to this, which isn't as frequent, but does happen, I know people that this has happened to, is IRL events.
Yeah.
Where there's people that have been kidnapped.
Yes.
Or, a lot of crypto influencers and people go around, they're flashing, they're on their Twitter. It's just like, oh, it's like 20,000, percent return on invested capital. And that leaves you open to, potentially, a physically threatening situation. And that's not something that we want to really be a part of. So it is, it is difficult to navigate. And then, what if you forget your seed phrase or you lose the thing, or, there's a lot of these layers to it that, that I think a lot of people, at least my estimation, is that this next generation of Web3 adoption, will be people who are a little bit more comfortable, at least at the beginning, with a slightly more centralized solution. And I'm okay with that. I trust centralized solutions all the time. Everybody's like, oh, I'm Web3 native. I'm like, well, what's your website hosted on? AWS. Well, come on. You know what I mean? There's only a small fraction of what you're doing that is actually truly Web3. So I think there can be these sort of intermediary solutions. And I do know that there are some interesting, multi-factor authentication deals that are going on. There's a lot of clever people out there who are working to solve these problems. So it is an accessible problem. It's just challenging to overcome.
Yeah. I think one of my experiences of multi-factor authentication was, to move any sort of money, I didn't care how much it was, I would go through the same process, right? So you've got your face, then you've got SMS, and you've got email, and then you've got, a password, right? You've got all these things. You can add as many as you want on some platforms. But then it's so cumbersome. I just couldn't I just wish it was a lot easier, to be honest, to move in and out, right? But it was interesting to kind of go through that experience. But you know, you said you've run a Web3 marketing agency before. Do you still do that now? Is that one of-
Well, so I ran operations at a digital marketing agency,
okay,
and we serviced right. more traditional clients.
Right.
My brother runs a Web3 marketing agency.
Okay. Okay.
And so I've had a lot of exposure, and you know, we also did the majority of the marketing for some of the Web3 projects that I've worked on as well. So not exactly run my own Web3 marketing agency, but I have a lot of experience in traditional marketing agencies. And my brother's obviously pretty heavily involved in the space as well.
Right, right. Okay. So then I guess when it comes to that, what is your perception of what is a Web3 marketing agency then? What does it mean? Or to be a Web3 company? You know, I say I'm a Web3 podcaster. I talk about Web3 technologies and founders, but when you're looking at marketing, what does that really mean, right, to you?
Okay. So I'm going to be a little harsh here.
Yeah.
Because it's an unregulated space. And this is one of the problems where we're trying to solve, you know, with the influencer report, which is, you know, part of more like an AI Web3 solution, is there's almost a paint by numbers, at least in this last cycle and the cycle before that, when they're figuring it out in 2017, the ICO boom, it's, we're doing a token because token is a very easy fundraising mechanism, and right. you know, it's fairly unregulated. So, you know, you incorporate a Panama company or a BVI company, and you sort of, you know, you sort of offshore liability, and so it doesn't come back onto you. And then as a marketer, your job is, hey, this project, it doesn't have something that's live yet, but you can buy the token, which, for whatever reason, the token's available on the Web3 stock market, and then you can speculate on that, even though the token doesn't really serve a value. I mean, the purpose of the token is it has to have a utility. Otherwise, it's a security. And so everybody tries to justify utility through these various it does this or that. And Web3 marketers, a lot of them, not all of them, mm-hmm. right? A lot of them, they exist out there to essentially pump the token price. Yeah. And you know what I mean? And it's not necessarily legal. So I think that, it's a difficult line to walk, especially with regulation going in what I feel is a positive direction. I think that there does need to be some regulation in the industry, because people are like losing their houses over this. I feel like a lot of Web3 marketers, again, not all of them, they go out, they'll do, it's a paint by numbers, community management, will plug you into some other VCs, will run airdrop competitions for you, will put out articles, will do these things. And it's not necessarily the marketer's fault. Like the marketers are getting hired on to help this company generate awareness, and a byproduct or focus of that awareness is to get people to buy the token. People buy the token, it raises the price of the token, so mm-hmm. other people can sell the token, and it's like playing hot potato. So I think that this next bull market, this next cycle that we run into, that we're running into, will hopefully produce a different kind of marketer that isn't, or influencer, I guess, as well, because influencers are, you know, all of a sudden they have marketing studios as well. We literally paid $2,000 for a tweet one time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like one ETH when ETH was at 2000, like the last cycle or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why are we doing this? But based off of the engagement and response that we got, it was kind of worth it. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? So I do think that this next generation of marketers and the marketing environment will hopefully be improved, because as you touched on earlier, there's less of these token oriented projects. It's more tech oriented projects. But that is still a concern that I think we're going to need to deal with collectively, because the losers are not the VCs or the companies. The losers are the new people who are trying to get into the space.
Right.
And those are the ones we want to keep in there.
Right.
And it only takes one bad, you know, Warren Buffett says, you know, you spend a lifetime building a reputation. It only takes one incident to ruin the entire thing. And I think that's what some of these bad situations have done to a lot of people. It's just totally turned them off to Web3 technology.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think if we look at the what you just mentioned as Web3 marketing, I guess to me, that's what people are considering is native, right? Because their intent, even though they don't say it right away, when people come to me, essentially they want you to shill their project because they're going to have a TGE and they want to basically get some money out of it. Now, understanding that it's not regulated and liquidity is expensive and it's not a lot out there for a new project. And if they can't get traditional VC money, then they try to do a token raise because it's much easier, right? Get it for the masses. If you can still do that now through some listing on some exchange, like, you know, what Binance had that bomb, it's insane, right? And I just kind of feel like it's the, it's maybe the last cycle that this will happen because regulators around the world in different jurisdictions are still putting things in place.
Yeah. I totally agree. I mean, there, and that's not to say that there aren't token projects that don't have true utility,
right?
But I would say it's, I this is just a guesstimation. I'm just some guy, right? Yeah. It's like 95% don't actually have the true utility that's required to, you know, be like, hey, yeah, you should have a token because we're going to use these tokens for a very specific utility instead of you're using the tokens to raise capital against. So, I mean, it, this is hopefully, I think, the last cycle that we'll have to deal with this sort of craze because, you know, I saw that Bong token. I know people that have made like a lot of money off not a lot of money. And I'm like, man, it'd be cool if I had a couple of these meme coins right now. I get it. It almost markets itself when you start seeing returns like that.
Sure.
Because people look into that and this sort of greedy, you know, human nature that I admit I saw that Bong token. I was like, oh wow, I should have listened to some of my friends who were like, you should buy this. You can't help some of these natural inclinations.
Yeah.
I think as this industry matures, because it's like, you know, it was a baby and we're like, oh, Bitcoin, you know, whatever. Like, and then you have the Dogecoin, which was on like our was like a spinoff from the subreddit because they were bored at the price action of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And now that's like a legitimate thing. You know, you see all these things and then the ICO craze. And, you know, I think we think ahead. So I remember 2017, everyone's like, oh, smart contracts.
Mm.
This can do so many things.
Yeah.
But then no one was really writing any smart contracts. They were just like, here's a token and here's the idea of the smart contract. And that's what that bus was. And then you started seeing some things in DeFi summer. And so we're, you know, I think we're always going to be thinking a little bit ahead. We're always going to be like a little optimistic about the technology. And that's going to drive some of the speculation. But I do imagine that this will probably be one of the last times that we're going to be dealing with some of this overhype around things.
Right. Well, let's look NFTs, right? Let's look at the dark side of NFTs. Now, you know, these non-fungible tokens, they created a lot of buzz, you know, at one time before DeFi summer, I believe. But they've been plagued with scams. Even the Bored Ape Yacht Club guys, you know, some of their tokens were taken hostage, I guess, but they were returned. And, you know, there's a lot of intellectual property issues of whether a digital format of something that's physical, does it really, you know, tie them together, and there's a lot of market volatility. Where do you think NFTs will go? Because there's still a lot of arguments on, oh, but, you know, it has, if you have true utility, it can really happen. Yeah.
So I am not a huge fan of the way NFT technology has been branded and distributed. because a lot of the criticisms I feel like hold a lot of water. Like, oh, hey, it's just a digital thing. I think there's some exceptions. I think people who I've been following for a long time, I also make 3D art for fun. And he's just this guy who's just every single day I'm going to put something out. Every single, he's so methodical. He's got, he perseveres through all this stuff. I think there are some people like that, that there is this, the idea of the value is going to stay there, but the majority of them are not, because people are overhyping the profile pic, but they're not understanding the underlying, the value of the underlying technology.
Right.
The value of the underlying technology is tremendous, but it's not in this speculative sort of way. If you're talking about art, it's provenance, self-sovereign identity, concert tickets. Like, there's a lot of these things, and you know, it can tie the self-sovereign identity thing, it can tie into being like an accessory. So there's a project that I worked on that didn't actually end up taking off because COVID hit and all this stuff, but it was using items on your phone in a real space. It was like my buddy was he ran a bunch of nightclubs, and it was a promoter for a lot of electronic artists in New England. And he had this idea for this space that was covered in like LED lights, and it's connected to your phone. And depending on your ticket, the LED lights around you would light up a certain color, that sort of thing, right? And if you think about the value of fashion, like an Hermes belt costs around $600. It's not worth that at cost, right? But people wear it because it's a status thing. So I do think that there's a lot of value that NFT can bring to your own identity. And I don't think there's necessarily a ceiling there. So I think that there is a lot of potential value in NFTs. I think they need to be rebranded.
Right.
Because if you hear NFT, you get clearly two reactions. There's no like neutral, like, oh, I don't think that, you're either like, I love NFTs, or it's just like, it's a scam, right?
Yeah.
So I think if we could rebrand that acronym into something else, and if people are using it and not knowing that it's an NFT, I think, it's a concert, it's a digital concert ticket that gets to my Apple wallet when I'm going somewhere. So you're not dealing with scams or whatever it is. Like, I know that's kind of like a rudimentary example,
right?
But, and I don't know it's an NFT. I think that there's a lot more value in that than being like, here's my picture of an ape, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then you have a lot of people that do like wash trading and things like that too. And then who ends up footing the bill? It's retail. It's all these new people. It's a similar sort of story to tokens. So,
yeah. So how much, wash trading or nefarious activity do you think happened in an NFT space? How much of it was real, or was like half the trades being pushed left and right for other purposes?
So you can look at on-chain data, and I didn't get too deep into watching and on-chain NFT data, because I never really speculated on NFTs. I bought a couple because they were my friends' like projects, or I got them for free. I actually at ETH Denver a couple years ago, if you got the Buffycorn NFT, you were able to get into a bunch of private events, and Vitalik was at one of them. I got this free like cat shirt that's shooting the Ethereum out of it. Like, I was like, I got my money's worth out of this NFT. But I do know that there are quite a few of these where it was a combination of things. Like, hey, we got this third party, this market maker or market maker. There's a lot, that's a pretty loosely thrown around term. Web3 market maker that would go and do wash trading. And, for those of you who don't know what wash trading is, you just buy a bunch of them yourself to artificially raise up the value of them. And especially if you have a smaller collection and you don't really care, or you're assuming people aren't looking at on-chain data, you can start to really raise that value. And so it's a lot of fake trades. And then you start getting some people involved. You get a marketer involved. Like, look at the floor price of this. Floor price is the absolute bottom price for the cheapest NFT. Look at the floor price. It's raised by an entire Ethereum in the last like 2 weeks. It's really, really hot. And I see this again and again and again. And then retail starts buying it, and they hit a certain threshold, because all they're doing is they're paying gas fees, right? And they're paying themselves. So the wash trading, they're not really losing a tremendous amount of value, and especially on a network like Solana, where transaction fees are really low. And then retail starts investing, and then retail hypes it up, and then someone at some point is just like, well, I've made my money, I'm going to cash out. And then you see this thing again, you see these little, like the patterns again and again and again, yeah. And they're big red bars down. So in terms of percentage, I couldn't tell you an exact number, but it was significant. It wasn't like, oh, one or two bad apples. Yeah. It was really significant.
Well, that was the one thing that always was, if you think about it, a lot of the stuff can be seen, the activity that can be seen if it's on chain. Some people are looking at it. I guess because you don't know exactly who owns those wallets, you can't really call them out, right? Yeah. Unless you have some indication of, the wallet and suspecting who the owners are, right? I actually had a brief introduction to a company called Tres Finance. And they were telling me about their platform in which they just need access to your public wallet and APIs into all these different read-only data that you feed into their system. So they can be information that comes from a traditional bank account. Money's going inflows and outflows. It could be from your environment for your wallet. Right, inflows and outflows, and what it's essentially trying to do is give you a holistic view of your actual financial health of all of your accounting of everything, like whether it be CFI, DeFi, TradFi, it doesn't really matter. It tries to capture everything. And I think it's pretty amazing because in many cases, like you think about some of the these DeFi projects, I always wonder. Their TVL when they say, oh yeah, we've got, $50 million. And then if you really look at it, if anyone was really smart, they say, okay, well, it looked like, millions of dollars were just pushed in, right? And you can say, oh, it was a market maker, or it was maybe a fund manager or something like that. You can create some story like, they pulled in all these retail guys in, but in reality, it's just one guy scratching another person's back to make it look like they're getting all this TVL.
Yeah, 100%. And that's like another thing with central exchanges. They require a certain amount of volume, a certain amount of liquidity. And that's why these market makers come in. There's even like automated tools that that people use, and it does paint if you don't have the wherewithal or the time or the effort to go into all of the details. Right. You can be like, oh, this looks great. All of these top level indicators of how healthy this project is look fantastic. But if you get one level deep, you're like, oh, okay. So this is all coming from these same two addresses and things like that. And I know that there are some fantastic on-chain projects that are trying to address this. One of them is called Arkham.
Yeah.
It's a really cool visualizer of what other wallets this thing is touched and inflows and outflows. I think that's also a pretty cool tool. We're also working on one similar to the influencer report. We've also worked on this wallet trust factor, which just shows like how trustworthy is this wallet. Originally we were thinking from the copy trading standpoint, but I'm thinking just from an information standpoint, like you input a wallet, how old is it? How often are they trading the news? Are they profitable? Is it just shuffling money in and out? All of these things are really important to understand, but we start running into a problem pretty quickly, which is the next 100 million users are not going to be native. They don't want to have the time or the effort, to go in and do all this research, do all this due diligence. And it's just like, well, you should do your due diligence if you're going to put money into something. But, there is this, there is a large group of people who are very interested, who have day jobs, who want to involve themselves in the ecosystem, and they're not going to. So it's like, if you present them one of these tools, it's just like, all right, set up a wallet. Oh, how do I do that? You know what I mean? You get to step one and it's already, you're losing a percentage of people who are coming on board. So I think the next like we have a lot of the tools, we have a lot of the infrastructure. It's just the next generation has to be this thing that sits on top of everything and I guess adjusts to your comfort level, your experience level, and your risk level. There's a lot of these sort of variables that you need to take into play. And so I think those are going to be some of the big winners this next cycle. So,
well, you mentioned this next cycle having more regulatory, guardrails in place, and you think it's good. But how do you think that will impact the industry in where it started, right? It's decentralized, no central authority. Everyone's getting really excited about this Bitcoin ETF, and institutions coming in, but institutions, they love regulations, right? They need it to be regulated in order to operate, you know, pretty much their whole business. So how's that going to impact sort of like the whole vision of this, where it's going?
That's a really good point. I think when it's BlackRock, when it's Larry Fink who's doing things, I'm inherently like, no, I don't like it. And I don't think a company with, you know, over $9 trillion in under active management should. I don't think they care about people. It's an entity that's done very well. Yeah. But I don't think it really cares about people. So I'm very hesitant when I hear things like that. But I think regulation is not going to be able to stop a lot of the decentralized nature of things. And that's something that I really like. What I do want regulation to step in and do is, hey, you're a central exchange, get the right licensing, you know, KYC, you know, do what you got to do on that side. So when there is something like FTX or whatever, the right people are held accountable. I think also regulation from, hey, your token project will get a license. You know what I mean? I think it's like an in-between case. Like fully regulation means, oh, in order to have a MetaMask wallet, you got to KYC. In order to do anything on chain, you got to let the government know. I'm not for that. But what I am for is, how do we help people not bet their entire house on an NFT project that's a rug pull, you know, a few days later? And how do we get on the building side, on the people who are, you know, if you think about, oh, I'm a token project, or I'm an NFT project, and I just started this company. I am essentially a central authority in, theoretically, even though the tokens are distributed in a decentralized manner, I created them, right? So if you are the sort of central point of authority, then there should be some accountability that's put there, you know, so that people are less inclined to do these rug pull things. And we're starting to see some justice, right? Like after the Terra Luna, I was like, oh man, this is awful. But you know, he got extradited to I think it's South Korea or the U.S. They both want him, but you have SBF, you know, and it's crazy. If SBF had just kept the Ponzi scheme up like a couple more months, like his Bitcoin portfolio would have like been able to cover those losses.
Yeah.
You know, CZ starting to pay these fines, and will likely see some jail time for, you know, essentially laundering money for cartels and things like that. So I think these are good things. I don't like seeing people go to prison or whatever, but I even worse than that, I hate to see people lose their house or lose a lot of money or lose their savings because they were duped by good branding and copy into buying into something that ended up not working out.
Right. You ever hear that one analysis where they talked about looking at the largest players in the world, such as BlackRock, right? And you've got Vanguard Group and State Street, all these guys, the amount of money that they control, and they are essentially the largest shareholders in pretty much every major vertical, right? You can say hospitality, you know, you can say airlines, you can say who owns the oil, you can say their money is everywhere. So when they were saying, well, who actually controls everything? It's not the president. It's not the government.
No.
It's the CEO of BlackRock that decides what happens. Right? What's your thoughts on that? You believe that?
Well, and they all own a piece of each other as well.
Right, right.
That to me is very deeply concerning when they are seeing a future where everybody rents everything. Nobody owns anything.
Right.
And they also own, you know, they also own lobby groups. They own media groups. They own the narrative that most people are paying attention to.
Right.
They can, and I'm not saying they're evil. I'm not saying it's the Death Star. but I'm saying that if they want something done, it's their decision and not yours. And to me, that is deeply concerning. And like I said, I don't trust anything that comes out of them or the things that they own. Which is why I think, you know, Web3 technology is needed, because it gives more people a voice. Mm-hmm. We can talk about like DAOs and how that could possibly be a future of government, or at least replace some of the lack of these tribal communities that we've gotten away from. I am concerned about the sheer amount of wealth that these countries, or these organizations have. They own each other, and they own more than most countries in the world combined. And you see the income disparity across the globe is widening and widening as well. I think the top 1% owns as much as the bottom, like 50% in the United States.
Yeah.
And United States, like GDP is supposed to be great.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay, there's a lot of these things that don't really add up. I do see Web3 as being a potential solution. I see the ETF being beneficial and not beneficial. Beneficial because, like, oh, what if they buy up everything like they're doing with housing? Mm. But they're also spreading awareness, and they're making it more of like a normal household name as well. So, you know, there's a double-edged sword there. I definitely don't trust them. they don't have my best interest in mind.
If you don't trust, okay, so let me ask you, have you followed that guy, Andrew Tate?
Andrew Tate, yeah.
Do you believe in his whole moving towards a lifestyle to remove yourself from the matrix? The matrix being the government basically wanting the majority of the people to keep on working, to take on more debt, so they keep on working to produce the money that the government needs to run its wars and to do whatever it wants to do.
So yes and no. I mean, the military industrial complex does dictate a lot of how I think we perceive the world, because they also own a lot of the media companies.
Sure.
And they're also owned by State Street, Vanguard and BlackRock. Andrew Tate's dad was a CIA agent though, as well. So it's like, you know, how much of this do I believe? How much of it is misinformation? I do find it really troubling that we continue. Like, here's something: every country in the world's in debt. To who? You know what I mean? Just like some of this stuff out, like, and you know, to oversimplify things, there's like, well, we're borrowing against our children and our children's children, and so on and so forth. And it's just like, well, someone's got to foot the bill. It's like you maxed out a credit card. And instead of paying it off, you're like, hey, give me a higher limit here. So I think that's also pretty concerning. So I agree and I disagree. You know, there is this sort of matrix. There is the status quo that they, you know, not the conspiratorial they want you to adhere to. You know, I'm not sure if Andrew Tate's lifestyle of women and cars and smoking cigars is really the way out of it. I don't disagree entirely with him, but it's also like, well, take it with a grain of salt. His dad was a CIA agent. You know what I mean? And it's just like, you get a lot of these guys who try and throw, in my opinion, who try and throw like distraction in there. Alex Jones as well. Alex Jones, he was right about the frogs, but his dad was an intelligence officer as well, right? So it's like so there's some truth in there, but there's also some distraction as well, I think.
Right. So. Well, the reason why I bring that up, because I think one of the messages, like I follow Andrew Tate, and I think a lot of his core messages, they have some meaning. I mean, there's mm-hmm. something behind it, right? And I believe that a lot of the things that he does is purely for entertainment purposes and to mm-hmm. draw attraction and to, you know, have that voice, which you kind of need to do in this day and age. But one of the things that he always talks about, and, you know, not following the matrix, not following the herd is how I read it, but it is finding your financial independence, which has been a huge message in the US for many years, self-made millionaires. And then you start looking at crypto and essentially there's all these kids, right? Or, you know, you can say influencers, crypto guys, whatever. All these guys are now much younger. More millionaires are being made in the US than ever before. And there's this drive to get into Web3 and crypto because they think, you know, this could turn their life around. And this is not only the US. This is in underdeveloped countries, you know, Africa, Philippines, Vietnam, a lot of crypto activity coming out from those places because to them, if they invested like even a dollar, let's say the Bonk coin, and they came out ahead at $20 or whatever, right? That's amazing for them. This is like, it's really kind of like changes the, not their life completely, but it changes their situation quite a bit. Now, whether they lose it, that's a different story. But like, do you think that will continue? Like Web3 space encouraging, like, I'm going to start up this coin. I'm going to be rich. I don't care about the project. I want to raise money so I can do whatever I want in life, right? I mean, do you think it'll continue like that?
There's a couple of things here. I think that Web3 technology is here to stay. When I talk to TradFi people about it, they're like, oh, DeFi versus TradFi. I think they can both exist and they will both exist in the same space. For example, if HSBC uses Web3 technology to resolve a contract 2 days faster because of, you know, the logic that's put in place and the security that exists there, you can multiply those 2 days over however many times a year that contract needs to get resolved, and you can see a quantifiable impact to the bottom line. Hmm. So I think that there's a ton of opportunity like that one, which isn't as sexy as the Bonk coin, that you can create this value. I think also when you do take the risk on yourself, because right now when I go to the bank and I deposit money at Citi or Chase or whatever, they take that money and they lend it out to other people, and they make interest on that. And my money just sits there. And my interest is not keeping up with inflation, especially these days, it's not keeping up with inflation. So I feel like another slightly less sexy route that's going to serve people more than it is currently is, if you go and you take your stable coins, they're very safe. You know, I'm using safe, you know, nothing, not financial advice, right? I'm not a financial advisor, but there are safer methods in which you can lend that out with low risk or lower risk and get higher returns than you are currently by having your money in the bank, because you're taking on that risk. And, you know, with some of these DeFi mechanisms, you know, you can make your money work harder for you. I always say that, you know, DeFi users, they don't care what money they're what chain their money's on. They just want their money to work harder for them. And I think that's a fundamental, like, imperative. That's global. That transcends cultural bounds, regardless of where you're at. And especially, countries that are developing are really seeing that the advantage is there. I know for a fact that there's going to be a lot of people who make a ton of money speculating and doing TA. You know, my brother does a lot of day trading and stuff, and you can get really deep into the charts. And, you know, I'm not saying that doesn't exist, but I think that there's some of these other areas that are slightly less sexy, but have longer legs, you know, because if you're just trying to make money really quickly, well, there's a bull market potentially on the horizon. Good luck, you know, take $1,000 and see what you can do with it. You know, like 2019, 2020, I did like 7X just doing that, just speculating that. Like, I've been on that side of things. Yeah. And I've also been on the other side where I've lost, like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars just in the wrong places, or, you know, getting scammed or whatever have you. And it hurts. It hurts a lot. I think there is this wonderful opportunity that's available to us that can level the playing field, I think that we need to be mindful of the kinds of playing fields that we are on and mindful of where we're getting the advice from and what fundamentally we're trying to do. Like, if you're trying to go and play the speculation game, it's like when I go to a casino. Like, you know, I like going to the slot machines in Vegas, and then you get free drinks and you just watch the colorful screen. I never bet any more than I know I'm going to lose. I'm going to walk away from the casino with no money, but I'm going with my friends, a couple free drinks. It's fine. That's what I would treat that as. But if you really want to make long-term, you know, generational wealth, or you want to change, you know, your situation fundamentally, I think there's some of these other less sexy avenues that you can really be successful at that aren't being attacked right now, because everyone's like, oh, Bong token or this NFT thing over here, it made me 1,000x in 3 days. If you're willing to extend your time horizon a little bit and be more sustainable, you'll get less headache, right? You won't have to deal with the scammers. You won't have to deal with the hype. And long term, you'll be in a much better mental, physical, financial shape.
Yeah. Well, I like that point. And I think that's one of the key shifts that I see. I mean, even in the TradFi market, there's still speculators. That's always going to be there, right? So that's a type of investor that you're looking at, which I think is very important to understand. What is the type of investor, if you go mainstream, who's going to come on board now? They're probably the ones, in my opinion, that will have a longer time horizon. And what that means is, if you look at the world today, and let's, you know, we're both from the US. We look at the US market. There's probably a ton of people who have not done enough effort into saving money, right? But they always say, you don't have to be that day trader, right? You don't have to go after the fast money. If you're willing to put your money in, let's say, what, the S&P, right? It is proven time and time again, after 7 years or so, you'll probably double your money, right? It's kind of like some rule there. And it's been proven, right? And even if you just fight it through the bear market, leave your money, let it sit, it'll go up. And this is kind of, in a way, like, you know, if you're able to participate and you have your own assets and coins that you stake, and it gives you a much higher percentage than what the S&P has been, what I think they're like around 10%, right? Let's say you can get 15%, 20%. Yeah. It just accelerates your time to your financial independence, or like greater financial stability in the future. And I think that's the exciting part, actually, for me, you're taking on the risk. Therefore, you should get more. If you don't want to take on the risk, then go into, I don't know. I mean, they have bank account deposits now that are earning, 4.5%. So it's changed a little bit, because before, I remember it was a time, it was like, 0.25%, you couldn't get anything. Now you're getting something significant. But to your point, all they're doing is they're taking that money because they're putting it somewhere else, and they're still making money off your own money, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the most exciting part that I'm seeing. Not so much the get rich, short term horizon stuff. Yeah. All right. So let's see. We talked about. Let's see. What else can we cover? I did want to talk about maybe some of the security vulnerabilities in general. So we talk, I mean, there's a lot of hacks. If you look in total volume, just still millions of dollars being hacked left and right from different projects, from different DeFi platforms. And we all know that in order for things to go then mainstream, what on the security front, what needs to happen? Because it's not happening like from the, like maybe some people are getting hijacked, you know, in real life, you know, or whatever the case may be, or even online. Like I've heard these instances where some girl comes online, talks to the guy, try to act all friendly and, oh, can you teach me about crypto? And they scam the guy into to giving. Yeah. All right. So there's all these stories, but yeah, for the large, hacks that are happening, what needs to happen? What needs to change?
Well, fortunately, that sort of thing is only going to get worse with AI and deepfakes. That this is not just in Web3, like across the board. I think this is something that we need to educate ourselves on, like everybody. Like I've told my mom, everybody, you know, you got to watch out for some of these things. I think on the actual tech side, one of the problems that I've seen, there's two sides to it. One of the problems I see it is you've got to get your code audited and you need a good auditor. And a lot of people don't want to pay the price because I won't say their name, but a very, very high-end auditor, I got a quote from, and it was $40,000 a month as a retainer, or it was $40,000 per contract, something along those lines, right? Okay. It was an astronomical amount of money. And also there's no guarantees. So if you do get hacked, they're off the hook. So the two sides are, okay, hey, I'm trying to get the thing to market very quickly. And I have investors, or, you know, I'm trying to get investors. So I'm trying to have an MVP out. And the other side is you have these auditors that are like, well, everybody's got so much of this VC money. We'll just, you know, we'll get as much of this as possible and we don't bear any liability. Right. So I think this is one of the ways that we need to adjust the relationship between auditors and builders. It would be great to have it internally, but honestly, it makes a lot of sense to have a third party come in instead of just having an internal security person. Having a third party, an objective outside set of eyes, look at what you're doing is so important. And across the board, creative endeavors, if you're writing something, if you're publishing something, you want to have a third party look at this. So I think having good auditors that aren't going to charge you an arm and a leg, that maybe do take some of the liability if they do charge an arm and a leg. I think that's one of the easiest, lowest hanging fruits that we can to resolve some of the tech issues. It's difficult when you get beyond this, because if, you know, some people are like, well, we'll just put in a emergency stop feature or put in some of these like admin features onto the smart contract. Well, then it's not really Web3 anymore. You know what I mean? And then you can have the hack from inside. And there's been a lot of that as well. And so you get these disgruntled developers and things like that. And again, more reason to have a third party look at these things. So it's a lot of it's really just human error or human negligence or, you know, ego or whatever that comes into a lot of the security vulnerabilities, which is unfortunate.
Right. Well, yeah. do you believe insurance has a play in that? So, for example, I went through a process in one of my jobs where we looked at acquiring insurance for a certain amount of assets in cold and hot wallets. And part of that process, in order for you to acquire that license, they had to do their due diligence. At that point, in a way, it was like an audit. Now, how it was done, this was some years back. A lot of it was done by humans. They call it the four eyes approach. You always got two people, you know, different passwords sharing, getting into a vault and all these different things, which kind of still happens. Even though if you have got, you know, you put your keys in different areas around the earth, you know, you still have to find a way to audit that, all that stuff, right? And it's not only how assets are moved in and out of to hot to cold, but it's also the code itself, right? And basically there's no back doors, and you know, that's why I always wondered when I heard when I was reading all these things about FTX. So after FTX, they locked them down, but money was still being moved left and right because certain people had access and you just didn't know who had access, right? So yeah, I guess to the point, do you think insurance could play, like insurance that requires an audit to happen, maybe the cost might come down a little bit? I don't know.
Yes. And I know that there were some insurance, Web3 specific insurance protocols. I think Morpheus was one of them. This is back in the day. I don't know if they're still around. There's a lot of these projects that aren't around anymore because they weren't ever able to find the right product market fit, but maybe this next cycle. I do think insurance would be really, really helpful. How it goes about getting implemented, I would be curious because it's a very sort of dynamic, ongoing situation, and there's so many variables to account for. But insurance isn't a new thing, right? So it's just like it's not going to be a whole lot more complicated than where insurance is implemented elsewhere. Yeah. So I think if ideally what you would get is a company that has done insurance or a group of people that were part of other insurance companies before, and you get a couple of web hardware, or the hardware side of it, And I think that could be potentially really successful. That would bring the cost down. It would still cost though.
Sure.
And
sure.
People would have to opt into it.
Yeah.
But maybe that's where some of the regulatory benefits would come in. It's just like, hey, if you want to get this license for X, Y, and Z, you have to have insurance. You have to be able to protect your end users here. So, you know, it's like FDIC or whatever have you, like you getting some, I know people, as soon as they are like, oh, it's like a government controlled body or whatever, they get turned off immediately. But I think, you know, for sake of example, I think something like that could be very beneficial, especially in DeFi, especially in these spaces where you're handling a lot of money.
Yeah,
you're handling a lot of people's like livelihoods at some point, what I mean? Or their kids' college tuition or something.
Well, let's go back and maybe we'll kind of finalize everything around this topic. So we talked about security. We talked about auditing. We talked about insurance. We talked about the matrix and the government. Do you believe that there could be a DAO? You know, whether it be one or two, or basically you can call them, they become the oracles, or basically, you know, the overseers of what happens in these environments, not just for a country, but, you know, obviously within, you know, let's say everything that has to do with code, a DAO that kind of controls that. And I know DAOs had a lot of scrutinies recently because, you know, money was being mismanaged, so on and so forth. But yeah, what's your take on that?
I think DAOs are amazing. I think that there is the opportunity for a form of a DAO to have some governance control that would be beneficial. But to your point, there are some issues with DAOs, not just the mismanagement of money. I think that from what I've seen, there's a critical mass. And once you get over a certain threshold, you lose the community and people stop engaging, right? So there's only a small percentage of people that are actually engaging. I think that at certain sizes, DAOs are fantastic. So maybe you have multifaceted, like a DAO made up of other DAOs or something like that. And it turns into this like sort of multi-layered government system that trickles down to the lowest end users. And maybe I'm like, oh, I trust it. You're similar to voting. Like I trust this person for my DAO district, and that person, you know, is able to cast a vote here or something along those lines. And we vote on it with our, you know, with our wallet or the DAO token or something like that. We would need to have some clear guidelines around that, because I've seen a lot of these communities, they do so well for 6 months or whatever it is, or they do so well until they reach 5,000 people. And then a single person over that, it all starts to fall apart, or people get bored. I feel like attention span in Web3 is also, you know, it's narrower and narrower. But I do think, I really do believe that DAOs are, or the next generation of DAOs are the future of governance, not just within Web3, but like beyond that, right? Mm-hmm. Like imagine you're a politician, because there's so many politicians that like lie. It's just like, oh, a lying politician? No, of course. That are like, oh, if I get elected, this amount of money is allocated towards education. They get elected. They're like, well, that's what I said before. Things are more difficult now. But imagine having those things written into a smart contract. So as soon as they are elected, you know, it's fed into an oracle, and then the oracle provides, you know, the smart contract information, like, hey, this person won. And then that money's automatically distributed. And if actions are taken on chain, I think there's a lot more accountability there. You know, having things on chain is really important for accountability, and it can bring trust back to communities at large, because I think that's, you know, an issue we're dealing with right now. It's like, especially in places like the US, there's this political divide. People don't trust each other. They don't trust what they're seeing on TV. They don't trust, and there's no accountability. So I do think DAOs can help this space fundamentally. I just think that they need to, we need to be mindful of some of the limitations and how we could effectively deal with those limitations as well.
Okay. Well, hey, I think we're going to wrap up the show. I want to thank you, Angie, for joining. I think we could talk on for another hour about a lot of different stuff.
Sure.
I didn't even go through all my questions, but there was definitely a lot of good stuff here. And I think the main thing, I think for 2024, change will be happening. And I guess for sure, speculators will, that's one of the things I've accepted. It will always be there. And it's not particularly a bad thing. They're the ones, when I say they, it's that interest actually helps to make the market, right? In mm-hmm. many ways. So you can argue a lot of scammers, a lot of hackers, but that's how we learn, right? If that didn't happen, then I'd rather have it happen now rather than later, mm-hmm. when everyone is like involved, right? So I think, we'll see how it is. So I guess I'll ask you one last thing. In Web3 in itself, you know, what is who are the top three people you follow that you believe will really make a huge change in this space?
Oh, that's a good question. that's a really good question. Vitalik, obviously, I like him. I've seen him talk a couple of times. He's really awkward and he's never wearing flashy things. I just by the way he dresses and the way he carries himself, and he's always trying to bet on get the cheapest hotel. Gavin Wood from Polkadot.
Yeah.
I like him. Him and Vitalik are you know, they're longtime buddies.
Right.
And in terms of and I'll throw an influencer in there, not a builder.
Sure.
Chico Crypto.
Okay.
I like Chico. I think he's been really brutal about things for a very long time, and I like that. Even in the bull markets, he's pretty brutal, and I appreciate that. You know, there's some people out there who are always just like, oh, FOMO, FOMO, FOMO. And he's always just, hey, be cautious. Here's a long-term project that I'm very interested in, you know? I appreciate honesty at that level. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thanks for that. Thanks for joining the show. And happy to catch up with you again, sometime in 2024.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Thanks, Art.
All right.
Have a good day.
Hey, so that concludes this episode of the Startup Voyage podcast. I would like to thank all of you for listening to this episode, and I'd really appreciate it if you leave any type of comments that you'd like to share, because it helps to feedback on how I deliver these podcasts.